This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. The proposals for the site of a Walton Arts Center expansion facility are in. More than 24 proposals were submitted by the Monday at 5 p.m. deadline. Private developers, city halls, and chambers of commerce from around Benton and Washington counties introduced proposals, as well as a joint effort from the city of Fayetteville and the University of Arkansas that arrived Monday. But if you're anxious to find out just where an expansion will be located, you will have to be patient. The next step of the process is now just underway, the examination of all those proposals against a list of 15 criteria developed by Walton Arts Center. The highest priorities on that list include funding, parking, and the size of the site. Yesterday, Terry Trotter, Chief Operating Officer for Walton Arts Center, discussed what's next.
We now have a sense of who's interested and what some of the opportunities are. Now what we need to go back is really begin that one-on-one dialogue with people to understand what they're thinking, their perspective of how it meets the criteria, how we might be able to work together. So it'll be, with that many proposals, it will be a pretty long process, I think, and certainly one that we're going to take very seriously, because that's the whole point of this process, is we need to come up with a solution that really meets the needs of Northwest Arkansas and of Walton Arts Center, and we'll end up with a successful project in the end.
Will you meet with each of the people that, or each of the groups that send in proposals?
We will, we'll be meeting with anybody where there are questions or where we need to gather more information. So I would imagine we'll meet with many of the folks that submitted criteria or that submitted proposals. It will very much depend on the proposal and if we think that there are additional questions, but I do expect that for many, if not most of them, there will be lots of additional questions.
All of the submissions are posted at waltonartcenter.org. The proposal packages are almost evenly split between locations in Washington and Benton counties. There are 8 separate offers to locate inside Fayetteville, 6 for Bentonville, 6 in Rogers, another 3 in Springdale, including a proposal from the Springdale Chamber of Commerce and Perry Webb that includes 5 separate potential sites inside Springdale. There's also a proposal to locate inside Lowell. Terry Trotter says the goal is to have finalists or a finalist from among the proposals by the end of 2010.
It may be earlier than that, but certainly, we think the process can be completed within the next few months, and the expectation is that the facilities committee, upon reviewing all that, will present some candidates to the board, whether that's one candidate, whether that's 3 candidates. At this point, we don't know, but we do expect that, in that time frame, that they'll have some finalists to submit to the board to really move forward with.
She says since the deadline for submissions was just late Monday, it's difficult, no, impossible to say if there are front runners or favorites among the proposals.
I don't think that we can say at this point that we're leaning anywhere. Obviously the proposals just came in, and so, now we've begun the process of really looking at them and evaluating them. The criteria, that was why we went through a very long process. I mean, really, we took several months, and the facilities committee painstakingly really went through those criteria and defined and redefined and debated what it was that would make the project successful. So now with those criteria laid out there, the next step is to really understand, more than just read a proposal, but really understand what the various opportunities are to meet each of those criteria. So until we do that, there's no leading location, so to speak.
Still, inside Northwest Arkansas, the conversations about an additional Walton Arts Center space have generated plenty of discussion, rumor, and pontification. Surely, over the next few months, there will be some lobbying, even if gently, from people around the region to pick one city over another.
Oh, sure. I mean, this has been a community dialogue, really, since we started talking about this. I think that's an exciting thing, and I think that really speaks to, Walton Arts Center's place in the community. It's clearly a loved institution, and people have a lot of passion. I think that's what's ultimately going to make this a successful project, is that there's both a strong track record and there's a lot of community support behind it. So, the goal is to come up with a successful project and a project that serves the community's needs. And so, you know, in the end, I think that we will get there through this process, and that will generate some real enthusiasm.
Terry Trotter is the Chief Operating Officer for Walton Arts Center. She discussed the proposals for a site for a Walton Arts Center expansion in her office yesterday. Each of the proposals submitted and the 15 criteria those submissions will be measured against can be found online at waltonartscenter.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. The National Park Service has announced the beneficiaries of grants that will be used to help preserve historic battlefields in the United States. One of the recipients is Prairie Grove Battlefield State Park. The buzzing of cicadas mixed with the sounds of the passing traffic on Highway 62 fill the air at Prairie Grove Battlefield State Park. Superintendent Jesse Cox says the nearby urban development is one of the main reasons the park has been awarded an $82,000 grant funded by the National Park Service's American Battlefield Protection Program.
The biggest thing is that this battlefield is considered on the top 10 list of most endangered battlefields, which that is a category derived from encroachment of development. And because Highway 62 is getting ready to be widened and present a bypass around Prairie Grove, it is one of our boundaries. So that development, that construction, is a big contributor to that type of encroachment. So the American Battlefield Protection Program is who's producing the grant. They're the ones who have distinguished us as in that top 10 of the nation. So that has a lot to do with if you're awarded a grant. And so we were.
The National Park Service awarded 25 grants worth more than $1.2 million. Prairie Grove received the largest amount of funding. The majority of grants were given to battlefields listed as Priority 1 or 2 sites in the National Park Service's Civil War Sites Advisory Commission report on the nation's Civil War battlefields and the report to Congress on the historic preservation of Revolutionary War and War of 1812 sites in the United States.
The American Battlefield Protection Program puts out grants all the time. This one in particular, though, what they're doing, what this set of grants is for, the 150th anniversary is coming up, okay, in 2012, or 2011 it starts and goes through 2015. It was a five-year war. Ours, our 150 is 2012 because it was 1862. So that's the reason that this set of grants is going out, is that they want all the battlefields in the nation to try to give them some help, to do some special things to celebrate their 150th and honor all the soldiers and all the citizens and the communities that took place in those battles. Because it wasn't just the soldiers, it was everybody, and all the people that lived on this ridge were affected, and this whole part of the county of Washington County was affected years after this battle.
Grants were given to projects in 17 states and territories to support archaeology, mapping, cultural resource survey work, documentation, planning, education, and interpretation. The Civil War Battle of Prairie Grove in 1862 was the last time two armies of equal strength fought for control over Northwest Arkansas. The grant money will fund a project to delineate the locations and extent of major battlefield features within the state park through the use of archaeological investigation and GIS mapping.
There's three family home sites on the area, the Mortons, the Bordens, and the Rogers, and we want to find their structures. There's the Cane Hill to Fayetteville Road that goes right through the middle of the park, that Highway 62 basically replaced it, but we just don't know exactly where it went through the park. We have a good idea, but we're not exactly sure. So we want them to find that road and the ford where it crossed the Illinois River. We want to find, we know on from a map, from a soldier's map, that there were three mass graves that the Union made for the Confederates. And those bodies obviously have been removed and taken to the Confederate cemetery, but we want to know where those pits were. And we want to be able to basically find the edges. And so then we can mark them and sign them and interpret them.
The Prairie Grove Battlefield site has been a park since a group in the community bought 9 acres more than 100 years ago. It later became a state park in the early 70s. Cox says the actual battlefield was 3,000 acres, but the park only owns 837 acres. The park hosts Arkansas's largest battle reenactment biannually during the first weekend in December. The next reenactment is scheduled for December 4th and 5th of this year to commemorate the 148th anniversary of the Battle of Prairie Grove. Cox says grants like this one help expand knowledge of battlefield sites, which is important in preserving the country's history.
The Civil War was, even though it was a gruesome and undesirable part of our history, it's important. It was about families and Americans, and it's important that future generations know about it, learn about it, and can come experience it. And so that's why there's so many of them across the nation, for that very reason.
Federal, state, local, and tribal governments, nonprofit organizations, and educational institutions are eligible for the battlefield grants, which are awarded annually. Since 1996, more than $12 million has been awarded by the American Battlefield Protection Program to help preserve significant historic battlefields associated with wars on American soil. More information is available at nps.gov.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. One of the voices you'll hear as we expand our coverage of news and politics on Daily Ozarks at Large is Roby Brock. Roby is the editor and publisher of the website TalkBusiness.net and the magazine Talk Business Quarterly. With Roby's addition to our program, we gain insight into Arkansas business and Arkansas politics. He'll help us cover what's happening at the Capitol during the legislative sessions as well. Today, Roby sits down with two of the more prolific political bloggers in the state to discuss the November election, exactly 90 days away. Blake Rutherford covers politics from the left at blakesthinktank.com, and Jason Tolbert covers politics from the right at tolbertreport.com. Rutherford, Tolbert, and Talk Business form the Arkansas Election Line, which has been rating the high-profile races across Arkansas. This week, the three men discuss state cars, the race for the U.S. Senate seat in Arkansas, and the Green Party's chance of picking up a state constitutional office.
Well, in the Arkansas governor's race, an unforeseen campaign issue's kind of surfaced. The Arkansas Democrat Gazette's been reporting for nearly a month on the expansive and apparently unchecked practice of taxpayer-financed vehicles. Do you think this state vehicle story sticks to Governor Mike Beebe? Is it something that Republican Jim Key can get some traction from? Jason, I pose you the question first.
Well, Key has certainly been fortunate in the timing of the story. The story just continually trickling out. Seems like a new story is coming out almost every other day. That has helped Key. It's created an advantage, created an opportunity for him. The one thing that Governor Beebe does have going for him is he paid taxes on his vehicle when he was Attorney General, and that was some time ago. So that does help him as far as the storyline goes, but the timing of it has really created an opportunity for Key.
Yeah, what do you think, Blake?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it certainly plays nicely into a Republican narrative that spending is out of control all over the country. I also think it's a little too convenient for Jim Key. The state fleet grew substantially under Governor Mike Huckabee, and Jim Key didn't have anything to say about it then. So I think now the fact that he's bringing up the fact that there is a state fleet and that somehow Mike Beebe is solely responsible for that is not only intellectually dishonest, it's also a little too late. He should have been criticizing his friend Mike Huckabee, who actually endorsed him for governor.
All right, Jason, I'll give you a rebuttal on that one.
Well, I think Blake makes a good point. I mean, certainly the size of government has grown for not only during Governor Beebe's administration, but under Governor Huckabee's administration as well. Keith is actually running on a platform of reducing the size of that state government, whether it was under a Republican administration or under a Democrat administration. He's running against the size of government, not just against a partisan issue.
Let's move on to down-ballot races. Lieutenant Governor, Secretary of State, Land Commissioner, you've got the vehicle drama, this sour national political mood for Democrats. Blake, I'll ask you first, is this political environment, do you think it's ripe for Republican upsets in Arkansas, or does it just make the races closer than the normal 60 to 40 margins that we've seen?
Yeah, I mean, Roby, I think you have to look at the overall demographics. I mean, registered Democrats outnumber Republicans about 2-1, although there's a growing number of independents in the state of Arkansas who you have to think are going to look at each race individually. Still, Democrats have had a lot of success at the constitutional level statewide. I don't think there's anything about any of the Republican candidates thus far that is going to shift that trend. I think if, and Jason's talked about this a lot, if there is a rising national tide for Republicans, that's going to have a trickle-down effect. If John Bozeman is very successful in November, that's going to impact Jim Keat and Mark Dar and Mark Martin and other people on the ballot. Is it enough to get them over the hump, though, to victory? At this point, I doubt it. They're still way too unestablished and really haven't been able to set themselves apart from their Democratic opponents.
And Jason, what do you think? Is the environment ripe for Republican upsets?
It's definitely ripe for it, Roby. The Gallup poll that came out this week for the first time showed more people in Arkansas identified with the Republican Party than the Democrat Party. That's probably the first time that's been the case in the history of the state. I think it's going to be the first time Republicans actually having an advantage, having a Republican and having the R after their name on the ballot. That's going to create an opportunity for them. Now, people don't vote generically. People vote for the candidates. They're going to look at who's running in this race, and they're going to vote for who they think will do the best job. But Republicans have a leg up, I think, for the first time in many, many years.
Well, State Treasurer Martha Shaffner received one of the blackest eyes in this controversy involving state vehicles. She originally said she was entitled to a state car, and she complained, I think somewhat jokingly, that she didn't have a manservant to drive her around like the governor did. She apologized. She backtracked on those comments. It did, however, draw her a Green Party opponent, former Representative Bobby Tullis. Jason, do you think that there's any way that a Green Party candidate knocks off this Democratic incumbent?
If they ever could, they'll do it this time. I think Republicans are kicking themselves for not nominating someone to run for that slot. He definitely has an opportunity. I think Martha's probably the most vulnerable constitutional officer that's running for re-election this year. If the Green Party is going to pick up a single race, it'll be that race.
Blake, what do you think? Is there any way a Green Party candidate knocks off a Democratic incumbent in this election year?
You know, it's tough. I mean, Roby, the power of incumbency is great. Martha Shaffner did very well in 2006 when she ran statewide. She has a lot of name ID. You have to wonder, you know, 3-4 months from now, how much traction the car story will still have. I mean, the burden is certainly on her opponent to keep that story alive and to generate some momentum. But remember, we're talking about a state treasurer's race. We're talking about a race that is very far down the ticket. I think a lot of people are used to voting for Martha Shaffner. I think there are going to be a lot of people in November whose minds are elsewhere than on the car issue. So if this is indicative of further campaign hiccups, sure. But I think one or two other things have to go wrong for Martha Shaffner before we can really consider her to be truly vulnerable.
All right, let's turn our latest to the Arkansas U.S. Senate race. John Bozeman, a hefty lead in the polls versus Blanche Lincoln, a hefty lead with money. What wins out in that matchup, Jason? Polls or money? You wrote about this recently.
Well, as I said in my column, I think it depends on how you spend the money. Obviously, John Bozeman is sitting pretty right now. When you look at the polls, he's got anywhere from a 30-point lead to about a 19-point lead. Way ahead at this point, but Senator Lincoln is sitting on a large amount of cash. And so how she spends that cash for roughly the next 90 days will determine the outcome of that race. John Bozeman, for the most part, is undefined outside of his congressional district. I think she's going to spend that money to try to define him. How she does that, I'm not sure. But if she does it adequately, she can make this race tighten. I think it will tighten, but I don't think she can catch him.
And Blake, you're number one on the Lincoln distribution list for political advice. So you tell me, what wins out in that matchup, polls or money?
Oh, I'd rather be ahead in the polls than ahead on money, especially if the lead is what the polls suggest John Bozeman has, which is why Blanche Lincoln's got to start spending her money. You can't wait until after Labor Day. The Lincoln campaign made a huge mistake in 2009, letting letting interest groups define her around health care. We're seeing that nationally people now really like the health care bill. She let interest groups define her around the stimulus. We're starting to see now that the stimulus had real positive things towards our economy, and now she's letting John Bozeman just kind of coast by through the summer. He doesn't have a lot of money, and he doesn't really have an issue except that he doesn't like what's going on in Washington. If I were Blanche Lincoln, I would be spending a lot of money right now. I would be telling people exactly what was right about health care, what was right about the stimulus bill, what is right about children's health and nutrition, and what is wrong with being an obstructionist politician in Washington. And until she does that, I don't think these poll numbers are going to change.
All right, let's wrap this up. I told you both before you came on I was going to ask you for some predictions, so I'm going to put you both on the spot. Blake, you first. One bold prediction that we're going to see here in the near future.
I think in the near future, you know, Roby, I'm going to go all the way to November. I think Republicans will gain seats, but I think it's going to be a far less number than people expect. We're seeing two very important trends. Public opinion for health care is way up, and it's continuing to climb. And we're starting to see that Republicans are really in a box over the issue of what to do about the Bush tax cuts. They're taking a hardline position that they want tax cuts to extend to the wealthy. And in order to do that, they're going to explode the federal debt. I think those two issues, when people really focus on them and understand them, 3-4 months from now are going to have voters really questioning whether Republicans are true to their fiscal message. I think Democrats lose seats in the House in November, but I think it's going to be far less than people expect.
Jason, your turn.
Well, you know, bold predictions can certainly get you in trouble. I think Blake has really made an example of that on your show. But my bold prediction is I think after November is over, I think we will have three parties hold constitutional offices in the state of Arkansas. First time in history, three different political parties will have elected someone to a constitutional office.
All right, that is a very bold statement. Now I'm going to put my prediction out there. I think that there's a possibility that a candidate for statewide office drops out between now and Election Day. That's all I'm saying right now. From the left, he is Blake Rutherford. From the right, he is Jason Tolbert. As always, guys, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
It's always fun.
Roby Brock covers Arkansas business news and politics at talkbusiness.com, and he's a regular contributor to Daily Ozarks at Large. You can hear more from the previous conversation, including opinions about the 1st and 2nd Congressional District races, at ozarksatlarge.com this evening. Support for Roby's coverage of Arkansas politics is provided by Hendricks College, a residential undergraduate liberal arts college. Learn more at hendricks.edu/odyssey. And the Little Rock National Airport at fly-lit.com, where travelers can book air, car, and hotel reservations online, track flights, and check the weather. Mobile phone access is also available at fly-lit.com/mobile. And Bank of the Ozarks, offering the tools and services to make Arkansas businesses work. More information is available at bankozarks.com.
A new interactive website is helping visitors assess floating conditions on the Buffalo National River. Gauging stations located near Boxley, Ponca, Pruitt, Grinders Ferry, and Dillard's Ferry have been designed to measure the river flow and water levels. Kevin Clark, Chief of Interpretation, Education, and Cultural Resources for the Buffalo National River, says the website will make this information more accessible than it has been in the past.
The system that we had was, cumbersome, that we had a system where we had river level gauges, which were just fine, but then trying to inform the visitor about what the actual conditions were was a little bit, I don't know, a little bit maybe old fashioned in a way. We thought about putting in, you know, color coded posts and you know, just kind of a way to tell people what the river level was, signs that we need to flip at certain times of the, I don't know, if it gets into flood stage and things like that. And some of those will continue to do because they're in the field and people need to be informed if there's a particular hazard or something. But we just really wanted to upgrade. And in this partnership with the U.S. Geological Survey, saw the opportunity to use their expertise. And it's something that they've done at a number of locations, not just Park Service, but a number of locations, and to get her on the web, where a lot of people who are planning their visits, either well in advance or just even in a day, can get an idea of what the river conditions are going to be like.
Clark says several organizations have helped get the website up and running.
The money's coming from a variety of sources, and I hope I can get them all right. You know, the USGS is putting up a certain amount, and the Park Service is putting up a certain amount. I think it's significant, and it's when you actually use the website and start clicking on some of these locations, the concessioners, the people that rent canoes, john boats, tubes, and provide other services to park visitors have contributed to this effort as well. And so it's really a combined operation with a couple of federal agencies and then private contributors as well. And they're the ones who are advertised on the USGS website.
The five gauging stations collect stream flow, water level, and rainfall data. Water flow is recorded in cubic feet per second, and stage, or water level, is recorded in feet. Data are collected in 15-minute intervals and transmitted to the website once every hour. Visitors can access all of this information simply by clicking on an icon representing the location of one of the gauging stations on a map. The five different colors of the icons indicate whether the river is very low, low, moderate, high, or at the flood stage.
High, low, medium, all that stuff is sort of relative to a variety of factors. But really what we're addressing here are the kind of things a visitor, you know, what questions are they going to ask? And the basic question is it good for floating? Is this a good trip? Is this a good day for me to go? And so it's somewhere between very low, where you're going to end up taking your canoe for a walk, or, you know, high, where you're going to have some real skills to manage it, or a flood stage when, you know, you may just not want to do it that day because there's a lot of danger involved with it. So what we're really trying to do is give visitors the opportunity to make educated decisions about where they want to go, if they're going to go at all, and where they're going to go, or if they're going to have a float trip.
The website can also show the locations of canoe rental concessionaires, campgrounds, picnic sites, launch sites, and hiking trails. While the website is full of information, Clark cautions there are several other factors to consider when planning a float trip.
Irrespective of what information you're using, whether it's this website or some printed information or calling up a visitor center is, what this is telling you is what conditions are like at that place. It can't tell you that down around the next bend there's a gravel bar and you're going to have to get out, or may have to get out, or you're going to scrape bottom. You know, it's no guarantee, because the river is a very dynamic process. And if, for example, and we have them all the time, we have a big thunderstorm event and the river goes up and it goes down, there may be a gravel bar there that wasn't there last week. And you may have to, you know, haul around it or over it or something. There may be a tree down. There's going to be things that we have no control over and for which we have no immediate information, so that people using the river have got to understand what the risks are. And I'm not saying, oh, it's dangerous, don't use it. What I'm saying is be informed and be prepared, and you know, understand that there may be times when you're going to have to get out, and I've done it, you know, haul your canoe and then get back in and float for a while, and then maybe you'll hit bottom again. There's a section of the river that typically goes bone dry every year, and that's not reflected on this chart, because we don't have a gauging station anywhere near there. So, you know, what I'm saying is this isn't the end all. This is good information. It's real-time information, which is very important. But there's still a lot more to planning a trip than just saying, oh, well, ample water or low or moderate or whatever, and going with that information. You need to know a lot more about the river if you're going to have a safe and enjoyable trip here.
To access the website, visit ar.water.usgs.gov/Buffalo River. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thank you.
This is Ozarks at Large.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
What a Wonderful World was originally performed by American jazz trumpeter Louis Armstrong, who was born on this date in 1901. Armstrong was born in a poor section of New Orleans, Louisiana, known as the Battlefield. He attended the Fisk School for Boys, and it was here that he likely had his first exposure to Creole music. After dropping out of the Fisk School at 11, Armstrong joined a quartet of boys that sang in the streets for money. The young musician developed his cornet skills while playing in the band of the New Orleans Home for Colored Waifs. As he got older, he played at brass band parades and on riverboats in New Orleans. At 20, Armstrong started to be featured in extended trumpet solos where he injected his own personality and style. Nicknamed Satchmo or Pops, this musician came into prominence in the 1920s. He helped influence jazz by shifting the music's focus from collective improvisation to solo performers. Armstrong was also skilled in scat singing, or vocalizing using syllables instead of actual lyrics. Some of his hit songs include Stardust, When the Saints Go Marching In, and Dream a Little Dream of Me. During his career, Armstrong toured all over the world and performed an average of 300 concerts each year, earning him the nickname Ambassador Satch. In addition to performing, Armstrong also wrote 2 autobiographies and appeared in more than 30 films.
Al is so talented that he can probably do just about any event in track and field.
He's happy with that one, and the crowd knows it. Al Joyner, who barely qualified for this final round, his third qualifying jump put him into this final field of 12, well out there. And he may very
On
well
August 4th,
lead.
1984, Al Joyner won the gold medal in the triple jump event at the Olympic Games in Los Angeles, California. This victory made him the first American in 80 years to win the event and the first African American ever to do so. He attended Arkansas State University in Jonesboro, where he later returned as a coach. He was also the winner of the Jim Thorpe Award, which honors the best American field athlete at the Olympics. Joyner married track legend Florence Griffith, who became known as FloJo after her marriage to Joyner.
First pitch is hit high in the air, deep to left field. If this is fair, it could be. It is number 500 for Alex Rodriguez.
Just 3 years ago on this date, New York Yankee Alex Rodriguez became the youngest player in Major League Baseball to hit 500 career home runs. He reached this milestone at the age of 32 during a home game against the Kansas City Royals. The previous record was set by Jimmy Fox in 1939. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
We have made it to the middle of the week. It's Wednesday. Woo-hoo! And with me is Becca Bacon-Martin, editor of What's Up in Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Still excited, still trying to get my feet under me, so bear with me. Here's the question of the day.
All right.
If you take a villainous pirate captain, a goofball crew, two wealthy sisters and their nanny who have been kidnapped by the pirate captain, and 10 enthusiastic seventh graders, what do you get?
Boy, I should know the answer to that.
No, you shouldn't, because it's brand new. It's called Hijinks on the High Seas, and it was written by Allison Lowe, the youth librarian at the Fayetteville Public Library, which we can see from here.
Fantastic.
And it is the end of the summer treat for the kids who have been involved in the summer reading program. The 7-Ups, who are rising 7th graders who volunteer at the library, 10 of them got together to be in this melodrama. Allison Lowe wrote it. She did the set. She did the costumes. She's having a great time with the kids. And at 1 o'clock, it will be performed at the library. So shoo, scat, go there.
Got to get there now. Is that the only chance we've got
to
see
it?
All right, so get going.
Also, tonight is the 112th Tawnytown Great Festival. Tonight is Carnival Night, 4:30 to midnight, and live music starting at 7 with Charlie Horse and Big Smith. Pretty big names for free.
And that's free. That music is free.
Absolutely.
Still no spaghetti yet tonight?
No spaghetti yet tonight.
Okay.
I'll tell you when it's time.
Okay, very
and
good.
Beauty and the Beast at the Walton Arts Center.
Becca Bacon-Martin is editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is Ozarks at Large. The Boys and Girls Club of Benton County will host the 16th annual ExxonMobil Summer Classic Golf Tournament August 6th and 7th. The two-day fundraiser will wrap up with a beach party Saturday night. Special events coordinator Mandy Jane previews the event for us.
The golf tournament takes place at the Kingsdale Complex up in Bella Vista. Registration fees are $150, and that gets you 2 days into the tournament, Friday and Saturday. And tee times are 7:30 a.m. and 1 o'clock p.m. And we always have a great goodie bag for all of our golfers, as well as a golf shirt, and lunch and breakfast and all sorts of things. So it's a really great cause for us. And then we always end the two-day tournament with a beach party out at John Q. Hammond Center starting at 6:30. Tickets are $40, and you can pay at the door. And just beach party theme, very casual attire, just coming out to have a good time, and we'll have a great silent auction. People can come out and bid on some great things and just enjoy the night.
Some of the silent auction items include a Jimmy Buffett signed guitar, a Terry Bradshaw autographed jersey, and a signed photo of the 1957 St. Louis Cardinals. There will also be a raffle for tickets to a Texas Rangers game. All of the proceeds will benefit the Boys and Girls Club of Benton County, which offers several programs for students when they aren't in class.
We are an after-school and summer program where we open our doors for kids to come in and have a place to be after school and then during the summer for parents who are working and not, but just a great place. And we also put a focus on programs as well, so we do a lot of programs that kind of help kids with things of drug resistance and alcohol resistance and just learning how to be better citizens in the community.
More information is available by calling 479-273-7187 or visiting bgcbentoncounty.org. And that's about all the time we have for Ozarks at Large. Support for Ozarks at Large comes from Collier Drug Stores, offering a prescription refill hotline at 1-888-237-6261 and local delivery from 6 Collier's locations in Northwest Arkansas. More information is available on the web at collierdrug.com.
Ozarks at Large support also comes from The Garden Room, formerly known as the Ozark Mountain Smokehouse on Dixon Street in Fayetteville. The Garden Room offers indoor and outdoor rental space for weddings, events, and private functions. Photos, price lists, menus, and more are available at gardenroomcatering.com. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Eureka Springs, a listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. KUAF has proudly served as your source for NPR programming for the past 25 years. Remember, you can listen at our website, KUAF.com.
For classical music 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, tune in to KUAF HD2, available on your HD radio or online at KUAF.com. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. Don't forget, you can hear these programs anytime you'd like at our website, ozarksatlarge.com. Thanks for tuning in. Have a great Wednesday.